I nearly lost my breath. My heart stopped and I held my chest.
How could it be true? How could it be true?
Okay, so I'm here once again with the delightful Amy Bender, and it's been a few years, but now you have the novel, The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake. Amy, how are you doing?
Good, good. Happy to be back on the show.
Happy to have another native Californian here. I wanted to go ahead and start off with the notion of fantasy and magical realism. I mean, these are things that are contingent upon getting the reader to believe in the illusion. The Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake, I think, is rooted more in this kind of quiet domestic realism, more so than your other books. But I think, if we're permitted to use the term, it's also arguably a Los Angeles novel. There are little details like, for example, the apartment complex with the screenwriters moving in and out, and so forth. Near the end, of course, you have an interesting sardonic take on the Southern California foodie as well.
Right.
Well, they're here too.
Oh boy, are they here, right?
Yes.
Deeply here.
I'm wondering how much of this balance between the fantastical and the real comes down to devising the details. What do you need to do as a writer to just really get something along the lines of, say, this apartment complex and so forth?
Hmm.
Just to start off here.
Well, I mean, it was fun to kind of write about a place that I knew, because I've often written about places that are sort of mythical and not quite crystallized in some way. So I mean, for the LA apartment complexes, I've looked at so many of them and walked by so many of them through the years, so they feel really clear to me. So I think that was kind of fun to have as a foil or contrast to playing with the magical rules. And in some ways, I mean, some of the magical stuff that happens in this book is a little, it was almost scarier to write about the magical stuff in previous books, because maybe because it felt more rooted in the real. So I think I felt like, well, will people go here with me because I want to go here, but I don't know, you know.
Well, it's interesting because that apartment complex, that kind of detail, or even like the details of who lives in the neighborhood, that's not in your other books. And so that's why I kind of posit the question here.
Yeah, no, it's true. And it felt, I mean, I think there's a kind of tone quality or something that ends up feeling different. And for my first novel, For an Invisible Sign of My Own, which is, I think, when I was on the show before,
it must have been, actually.
Yeah, so that was, it may have been 10 years or something.
It's like a high school reunion.
Right. Exactly. Have you been?
Marcy was terrible. You know, she went ahead and threw up against the locker.
Marcy,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Like such a, that dates us both. It's like such a name from the 70s. But I knew a lot of Marcy's. So with that book, I knew that everything in it was sort of pushed to kind of strangeness, but nothing tipped into magic. And I felt really aware of that I didn't know how to sustain the kind of fairy tale like magic in a longer work. And maybe there's something in exactly what you're saying, which was that having the apartment or spending more time on the kind of setting and dailiness felt like maybe it was a way to have a backdrop for, like a kind of creepy backdrop in some way for trying to investigate some, like a magical movement.
Or a way for the reader to be pulled more into the believability of this power of being able to detect what the feelings are in terms of eating food and so forth. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I'm wondering how much of this is a shift in your own temperament. You know, we were just joking about this being a few years since since we last talked. This leads me to ask, I know you to be an optimist, both in your previous books and also in our previous conversation, which was quite jocular. But with this, I almost get the sense that you're exploring this positive pessimism with the Rose perspective. And I'm curious how much that may play into this, the idea of exploring a perspective that's just a little bit different from your own, or perhaps I have misjudged you and you have been a sort of closet pessimist the entire time.
I think I'm both. So it's both exploring a point of view that's different than my own, but of course, like for any of it to ring true, it has to ring true to me in some way as well. So I think there's something of that balance of kind of seeing things cynically and seeing things hopefully depending on the day.
Yeah.
We'll land in a different spot. But I guess, I think I did feel really focused in this book, maybe in particular, in thinking about what would be burdensome for that character and also what would be burdensome for the brother. And kind of maybe the tone again of the sort of magical quality about her and about her brother feeling different, like his feeling darker, hers feeling dark and his feeling darker. Or like I somehow think of them like triangles feeding into each other, like hers is the smaller shape and his is sort of this... just kind of a darker shape in some way.
But what do you do if you're trying to go ahead and channel this positive pessimism and you're just in an absolutely peppy mood that day? Because, I mean, I think that of all your books, this is tonally just very, very specific. And so, you know, what do you do to maintain that tone, especially since it's several years of trying to get this right? You know?
Exactly. Well, you know, I think it's, I have this kind of system that has worked for me so far, which is to write a couple hours in the morning. And in that way, and the rule, a friend of mine from grad school named Phil Hayes said, you know, if you write what you're interested in writing each day, the writing will have life in it, which was great. It was very kind of... it seems simple on the surface advice, but I think is pretty deep, because the idea that each day you can kind of generate whatever is happening on that day, it means that the optimistic days I probably wasn't working on that book. Or, I mean, the thing is, getting a good work day in feels very optimistic and hopeful, even if the work itself is kind of dour and sad and bleak. Like, a good work day feels so good no matter what. So there's kind of a contrast there already. But, like, let's say I'm in a really upbeat mood and I just can't get into the sadness of the book, then I would work on a short story. So it was all very mood governed. But there was something, I think once there was enough material to work with, it didn't feel sad to work on. It felt like explorative.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting, because I've always wanted to talk to you about the two-hour session.
Right.
Which sounds like almost an expansive psychotherapy now.
I've wondered about it like that. I think there's... it's a bit of a model,
But I understand, and I just want to get this totally clarified. You know, you sit on the couch, you want to channel your mind into boredom. And I'm curious about this. I mean, it seems to be a more reasonable answer to, say, Jonathan Franzen blocking all sunlight out from the room, which I think is really quite intense. I mean, I understand the need of...
I think he has headphones.
Yes, exactly. Earplugs.
Yeah.
I think there are bats that fly in his cave. I don't know.
But
the point is that your level of trying to remove yourself from distraction seems infinitely more reasonable. I'm in this fixed location. How do you will yourself into filtering these ideas? I mean, or is it a situation where you have so many ideas, so much information, so many emotions that you're writing that you just need to sit still in order to just access it for that two-hour period?
You said it in an interesting way, something like channeling myself into boredom, but it's not, it's just the boredom happens. I mean, it's the
boredom. Oh, come on, you're more than boredom.
Does not really need to be channeled. Or, you know, there are those people who are like, I never feel bored. Yeah. I'm definitely not one of those people. And I feel, so in some ways for me, it feels like a dance between boredom and concentration. And I think my concentration can feel thin.
Yeah.
So the idea is blocking out the amount of time so that I'm going to try to concentrate, but I don't know that I will. And inevitably I get bored. And then hopefully on the other side of boredom is something. And that there's this great quote by Adam Phillips, who's a British psychoanalyst, and he's talking about boredom as a waiting space.
Yeah.
And as this kind of interim place for a kid, where it's not something to be filled or plugged in, it's something actually to sit through. And then that's often where, like, a kid will get really creative, and they'll be like, okay, I'm bored. Now I've created this land under the, you know, kitchen sink, whatever.
So I use the term channeling, or willing yourself into this concentrated focus. Is it a variation of the Flaubert maxim, be calm and orderly in your life so you can be vile and original in your work, or violent and original in your work?
There is something to that. There is something that I do believe very strongly, that structure helps creativity, and actually boundaries in this way, it is kind of like a therapy hour, the boundaries of the time create a space that I can go to some place that is potentially like revolting to me and leave, and know I'm going to leave. Like, there's something very helpful about that. But still, it's not even like I can focus myself into concentration. It's just that the only rule I really have is I have to stay put.
Yeah.
And then there'll be many, many bad days. But
so if you stay put, you can confront any emotion. It's like riding the gauntlet here.
I think it's, if you stay put, stuff comes up. I think eventually stuff will bubble up and there'll be things to write about.
Uh-huh.
So, but it's not like I'm even sort of bravely have the sword in hand and I'm like rushing forward into the forest. I'm sitting there feeling like, I want to get up. And the only weapon I have is stay put.
Yeah.
You know.
Got it. Is it a matter of ADD or distraction or what?
It's
exactly?
Not ADD, but I just do feel easily distracted, or I'm not a writer. There are other writers who will say I need time to kind of relax and then get into it, and then I take 8 hours and then I get lost in the world and I feel all my characters, and I just feel like I don't have that at all, where it's really like maybe I'll get kind of lost in it for 10 minutes and then that's thrilling, but I get a lot done.
Oh, I see.
10 minutes, right? So it'll be like boom, productive, and then space out.
90 minutes of thinking, 30 minutes of writing, generally, something like that?
Yeah.
Huh, interesting.
Yeah, and looking at old files and rereading.
to go back to the idea of believing the details that we were talking about at the onset, Ursula K. Le Guin has said that in order for fantasy to be plausible, the writer must give absolute credence to the work of the imagination, dwelling on it while writing and trusting it to reveal itself. How much do you have to believe in order to get the reader to believe? How does a fantastical element transcend a mere gimmick?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great quote. I think you have to believe wholly. I mean, I think the writer has to be completely invested in it. If there's any crack in that, the reader will feel it and begin to doubt it. And in fact, I'm reading Kafka on the Shore, the Murakami book, now, and it's sort of like I've saved it for a couple of years because I needed to take a little break, and then I'm so enjoying it. And just always feeling with him that he'll make these outlandish moves, and he is, you know, the guy talking to cats, and cats talking back, and I always feel like he is so fully committed to it. I mean, 100% committed that I will go along with it. And it's just a very interesting experience of that. So I think, yeah, I think...
How many times have you read Kafka on the Shore?
No, this is the first.
Oh, this is the first?
Yeah, no, I'd saved it. I had like it tucked away on the bookshelf just waiting because I kind of...
Vonnegut's like that with me, but Murakami's like the author. You don't want to read them all at once. You want always want to have one down the
line.
Right,
and I know there's a big one coming out.
Of course, yes.
Right, but I think that'll
be
a few years.
No fear of him dropping off.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He's ridiculously prolific, which is great. But yeah, and Vonnegut's a nice kind of parallel for that. But so I think, I don't know, there's something about that believability or if there's any doubt, and there are many times I'm writing something where there is doubt and those things just fizzle away. If I just start to feel like, you know, there's nothing in this, there's no emotional drive behind it.
Well, like what happens if doubt, a wave of doubt overwhelms you? What do you do?
I'll leave it and go to something else. But often if a wave of doubt overwhelms me, it means there's something faulty in the premise, and that the premises I think that work are not, and this is, I mean, the way I've been thinking about the fantastical stuff recently is that it's all driven by an emotional push. So if the emotion is what's driving it, then the wrapping around it, this is where I feel like fiction, or look at someone like Kafka, Kafka's trying to represent something really frightening and beautiful about being a person, but he's wrapping it in whatever kind of container he can, or all these writers that I love, that I'm sure you love. You know, there's just these strange containers for this experience.
Yeah.
So if the experience is what's important, then the container doesn't matter, but the experience has to feel full. So I think when the container feels faulty, it means that there's something in the emotional life underneath it that's not really there.
Does this explain the several attempts of this particular novel? I know that there were efforts, and then you had to start again, efforts to start again.
Yeah, exactly.
Why do you think that the emotional life wasn't there? You know, for these early efforts.
I mean, I think I can sort of track stuff going on in my own life, but I also feel like, I mean, there were things, because I was working on this other book for like 5 years and then put it aside, and it was a relief to put it aside, but kind of heartbreaking to put it aside. And, but I remember feeling like, there were clues. For example, clues like, I'm going to give it to some friends to read, and, you know, if they can just get to page 287, I think they'll really start to like it then.
Wow.
So, and I was thinking that as if that was a totally reasonable thought, you know.
Wow.
And then in retrospect, it was like, right, that's not really what I want a reader to...
So what are we talking in terms of massive manuscript length here?
How long was that book?
Yeah, yeah.
It was like 450. It was long, but it had a narrative problem. Like, it was a strong voice, but there was not a drive. There was a lot of, like, ranting. It was the ranting character.
Yeah.
You know, and it wasn't, like, good Sam Lipsyte ranting. It didn't move forward like his does.
Why do you think there's a close relationship between empathy and fantasy?
Oh, that's a great question. And that's one I can't, like, I have to think about for a second. Well, no, I guess what it is, right? If the act of fiction in itself is an act of putting yourself in the shoes of a character, then fantasy is taking that to the nth degree, because it's suddenly the character does not even have to be human or can be going through some sort of whatever. And it's also trying to in some way concretize something about the human experience.
Belief creates greater empathy in characters and greater empathy in the world you're creating and the like.
I think that's true. I think that's true, but that's nice because it's... I had a student in the grad class last semester who said he wanted to get back into writing fiction because it increased his empathy in his life in general, which I thought was such a great confession. right, suddenly his kindness and softness came through.
Yeah.
But to think that even to another extent, to push into some fantasy world has the potential to take that along.
Got it. Typically, just to go to the book, we associate our feelings around food over anticipating it or eating it or, the great sort of post-orgasmic oh, that was a great meal.
Right. Right.
Here you have Rose given a situation in which, well, she can't have any of that because it's all about detecting the location and the feelings about this. It's always the origin point. I know that at one point in some of these drafts, Rose was actually an older man who was on the make for a perfect bowl of soup.
Oh, yeah, good. You do good research.
Yes,
that's
well,
good.
At what point, I'm curious, did you get these sort of...
Yeah.
But at what point did you get this limitation situation down? Because it just seems to me that, well, the answer was there all along. You just invert the way we look at food. I mean, it seems to me you probably had to think about food. Did you consult any gourmands? I mean, aside from,
sure,
of course...
Sure, yeah. Yeah. And I took some cooking classes. I read some cooking, but I read some MFK Fisher.
Yes.
I had a lot of fun reading food books.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I guess... So how did that evolve?
I think why wasn't that apparent in these early drafts, that kind of inversion of our relationship with food?
Right. I guess... I mean, I think in the early drafts, the kernel that was there was that kernel of what more is in food beyond food. So he was looking for something in soup, but it was something beyond soup. But so I think there's just something about that parallel between what do we ingest physically, which is food, and what else do we take in, and what happens if I glom all those things together in one kind of mush. So, but I think for that character, because it was kind of confined to soup, and I wasn't really kind of getting into what was in that soup, it was a lot more vague in some way. So there was something about allowing, I mean, and the thing that was important to me too is that it was not just that she's tasting the emotional life of the chef and the food, it's the kind of unacknowledged emotional life of the chef and the food. So it's just whatever's disavowed is showing up in the food and then eaten by her, and then she's sort of taking it in, which I think is a process that happens.
Yeah.
So I guess, right, so why...
Well, I think the answer is there, soup supra. You were probably looking beyond the experience as opposed to within the experience.
Right, exactly. And I think once it got closer to the kind of internal life, then it felt like really clear where to go with it, and I was happily writing for many pages. And yeah, and so whatever had been kind of stalling out before could push forward.
Yeah.
But the old man may show up in something else. Who knows?
That's really interesting. And I like soup, too. I'm curious to offer another angle of the book, and there are several. In describing how Rose's parents meet, you have Mom's roommate, Charlene, very passionate about cooking. Mom is scouring flea markets. I'm only saying Mom and Dad because you didn't actually name them.
They're mostly through her perspective.
Mostly Mom and Dad. We'll just call it.
It's fine.
Mom and Dad's relationship is really centered around a kind of bottom-feeding yet admirable consumerism oriented around garage sales, flea markets, and the like. And it's almost this effort to combat career expectations. I'm wondering when this notion of obtaining resources or making them malleable in the kitchen factored into the book. Was this idea a carryover of some kind from a previous draft? What did it arise from looking beyond the eating experience? How did that consumeristic aspect get in?
In terms of the consumer as an eater of another kind?
Yes, exactly.
I mean, that's a great question. I'm not sure. I think none of that was conscious, but I think maybe there is... I get what this is what I would say is the way they linked up in my mind that I was more aware of as I was working on it was the idea of what gets put inside objects. And so objects as things we consume and buy, and right, bottom feeders is a great idea of the garage sale as the sort of scavenging experience. But a lot hinges upon the relationships between objects and people. And in the same way, the food becomes a kind of object that mediates the relationship she has with all the people in her life uncomfortably.
Yeah.
And in that same way, like, it felt important to me that she's figuring out the processed food, the factory food, because it's connected to objects and not people.
Yeah.
So that there's just something about that spectrum between when do you relate to a person, when do you relate to an object, when does one substitute for the other, you know, and in the case of the parents, when does this stool become the kind of representative of the relationship, when you see a disconnection between the two actual people, but some connection via the stool.
Well, this leads me to ask, because in your previous books and your first novel, you're dealing with math teachers rearranging, you know, finding mathematical attributes to objects. In this, there's actually, you're almost steering off the whole mathematical association with fantasy.
Right.
But it's interesting you mentioned this, because I'm curious if much of the consumerism and the imagination themes of the book had much to do with instead of approaching a numerical quality for each object, you're almost approaching a kind of character attribute, like these saltine crackers come from New Jersey, packaged really stale and the like.
Sort of categorized in a way that is not dissimilar to a number.
Yeah. I'm wondering if you were consciously trying to dial down the numerical approach that you've had in the past to find a new form of precision or rhythm with the kind of qualitative aspect.
Probably. I mean, I wasn't that aware of it, but I think I didn't want to have numbers be a huge theme, and that felt like such a big part of the other book. But I think there's still an interest in kind of seeing things in a certain focused and maybe categorical way, and also critiquing that, like being interested and kind of compelled to write about things that way, and also wanting to undo it at the same time. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, no, but I also wanted to ask about the idea of Rose having difficulty finding people who truly care about food. This goes back to the positive pessimism which we were talking about.
That they care about food, but people who truly
truly are making it out of an abundant, passion or love for it. It just seemed remarkably negative. I would think that there would be more people in life who would enjoy the process of making food.
And I guess what I wanted it to come across as, right, was less, because I think you're right, there are a gazillion people who love making food, but that there were people who would be kind of inside of themselves in a way that she could tolerate, like comfortable with themselves in a certain way, in a way she could tolerate, so that whatever she would taste in the food would not be hidden. Like if she's getting a lot of hidden information, then, and I think that is much more common. I think you're right. People loving to make food across the board. I don't want to imply that I think there are a few people who love that. But I think, for example, there's a new place that opened up in Los Angeles called Cafe Gratitude, where they're like, all our food is made with love. And like, we really feel like it's important that it's made with love. And here are all the things you order. You order things called like, I am magical, or I am transformed. I mean, it's so hippie, and it's all, it's crazy. But so when I read
there's something weirdly solipsistic about that approach, too.
Totally, exactly. Yeah. So when I think that, I don't feel love. I feel controlled. Like, I have to say I'm magical? Well, I don't feel
magical
today.
It's like a mantra food place.
Exactly. I feel tense. I feel like ordering, I am tense. I am distracted. So there's a split there, right? There's a split between what they're presenting and what is actually felt. And I think that split it happens all the time. But I think her to find something that's not split, where someone is wherever they are and making the food so she can eat it because it feels integrated, I guess would be the word for it, then that maybe is rarer.
You required a submergal into these kinds of Los Angeles eating establishments related to the pursuit of the self and the libertarian drive.
That's
where the pessimism
recently
comes from.
Right,
that's the method writing there.
I think the pessimism just comes from feeling like I like to go. I went with a couple friends and like to go to Cafe Gratitude and sort of appreciate the mission and also feel like cynical about the mission because something is not being fully acknowledged.
Yeah. Wow. You know? That's
incredible. If someone says be grateful, it's harder to be genuinely grateful. Be grateful. You know.
Just like that, barking into someone's
face. Right, it's hard. Then people feel guilty. It's not the same thing. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I think it's made by the people who do that, actually.
Yeah, I'm sure. It's the vestiges. Erhard's got to stay alive somehow. If we are our own parents, and if we are our own family, I have to bring up the grandmother.
Yeah,
in this book, never wants to leave Washington State, sends strange packages in this effort to connect, as well as Joseph, who we've only briefly touched upon, the brother. He has this almost Edward Hopper-like fate near the end. I don't want to quite give it away.
That's nice.
Yes, but it suggests a kind of fatalistic determination here.
That's true.
No amount of autodidacticism, no amount of acceptance of other people's idiosyncrasies is really going to save these characters. You stop this novel right when Rose is around college age. I'm wondering if you made efforts to chart her life out beyond this, beyond that final sentence. Did you stop the book at a certain point to ensure that there was plenty of room for the reader to infer what Rose's adulthood was going to be? Or was this, as I detected, fatal determinism on your part?
I guess what I would say is I felt like, and I know I've gotten lots of different kinds of responses about the ending in terms of like where the characters left and would I do a sequel or whatever, but no, I wouldn't, because it feels to me like I kind of know where each of them is headed in a certain way, or it feels clear enough to me. But so I think with her, I mean, it feels like something in the ship the helm of the ship is directed in a slightly different place than it is at the beginning of the book, which means kind of the trajectory for her is different. But do I feel with him, right, the grandmother sending these objects, again, you have this sort of meaning in objects, I guess, or that she, her whole personality is displayed through these objects, which really speaks to him deeply. So yeah, I think there is his, you could say his fate is pessimistic or just sad. Like, I think it felt sad to write about.
Well, I'm not so much sure if it's pessimistic as it is deterministic. Right. I mean, if the grandmother is going to not leave, and if he's not going to leave, that's the question is whether you need to find this fatalism all along with which to either suggest to the reader,
That he couldn't.
This is, you know, no amount of revolt
studies
is going to.
And, yeah,
exactly.
I mean, for him, I don't know. I guess it's, I don't mean to feel that it was determined, but that it, I don't, yeah, I think there are factors that could have changed that path, but also certain things piled up in a certain direction to sort of box him in.
Did you write anything beyond that point in Rose's life?
No.
No?
No, I didn't.
Did you really think about that point beyond Rose's life to sort of get into some Hemingway iceberg stuff? Or?
Right. Not in terms of her, because I feel like at that point there's something shifting in her so that, and she's kind of opening up to the world in a different way, and that felt like enough. But yeah, no, I didn't. Yeah, I didn't. I think that hopefully the iceberg stuff shows up in the book as a whole, but not in the after part as much for me.
You've done the lack of quotes and dialogue before, but in this case, it makes greater sense to conjoin words and thoughts. What was the basis behind this decision?
So the honest truth is that it's more about a visual approach, or it's more about, you know, reading someone like Jane Ann Phillips or Cormac McCarthy or, you know, and Judy Budnitz, any number of writers that I've read through the years that haven't used quotes, and just really liking how it looked. So there is something, and then when I'm writing and I'm kind of involved in a scene, I'm writing it pretty fast and I'm not doing the shift space quotes, and then going back and inserting quotes, depending on the piece, can feel intrusive. So but I think exactly what you're saying is also true, which is that it is a book where the inside and the outside are very blurry. And so then why not have it where there's kind of this slight discomfort on the reader's part in figuring out, is it thought, is it speech, which is it, in the same way that she's kind of tasting. So that's kind of the way I can rationalize it.
Perhaps it allows the reader to believe in the illusion, because as with much fantasy, you could walk away from the book thinking, oh, well, it's in her head. Maybe the fate of the brother is not so hard line, so to speak. Yeah.
Right, which is, I mean, I guess any fiction is like that, right? It's a dream from the writer's head, so it's inevitably, you know, it didn't actually happen.
Got it. You pulled the JR out of the shower kind of thing, or Bobby Ewing out of the shower. I know that you baked cakes for this book. I'm wondering if there was any tangible research that went beyond this. At the risk of giving up the ghost, although I should probably go ahead and ask, to describe the chair moment near the end, to what extent did you occupy chairs or sit in specific positions to get that so precise? How much of what you write needs to be rooted in real experiential preparation?
Well, I have sat in many chairs in my life.
Well, of course.
I have quite a bit. Right. No, but I mean,
but this is serious chairs. This is a serious chair moment, Amy.
Right. No, and I had a friend of my mom's actually who said, well, isn't it kind of like your 2-hour thing? Isn't that sort of like disappearing into the chair, disappearing into the computer? And it's like, well, but there's a difference, which is that the hope and disappearing into the writing is actually a communication with someone else. And that's different in terms of his character. It feels like actually a total disengagement from all people. But so I didn't practice sitting in chairs, but I think I was, I don't know, I've always felt a little drawn to the image of a chair. There's something about a solo chair that can be a very potent image theatrically.
Yeah.
I'd seen my mom had done a dance with dancers in an empty chair, and I was maybe 12 when I saw it, and it was really powerful. And actually the dancer who sat in the chair and then left the chair at some point was named Joe, and I thought at some point in writing the book, I was like, oh, I think there's an echo of this dance in here. I even think, like, you know how the McSweeney's logo is like a little armchair?
Yeah.
They're very evocative of a person, but also an absent person. So so that image, I think, has just been something that has always been interesting to me.
Was Hopper an influence on that moment? Because, I mean, I thought immediately it was Hopper. Because it's such a bare space.
Solitude.
That was the first thing that came to my mind, especially the way you described the light or infer the light.
Oh, that's so cool. I mean, Hopper, I did go to a, maybe unconsciously, because I went to a Chicago exhibit of Hopper before I was even working on the book. And I remember really closely looking at all the pictures and feeling like, sort of different than the book in this way, but that his paintings are so much about solitude and they are not lonely. I don't find them like they feel they don't feel despairing. There's like a striking lack of despair, but also this incredible sense of solitude and aloneness. Which I think, you know, maybe that does fit the character.
He takes really putrid colors like yellow and green and he somehow makes them warm, even though it's depicting a solitude experience. There was a Hopper exhibit at the Whitney, and I went with some friends, and they literally had to tear me away from each painting. Like, come on, we gotta get going.
There's a lot of feeling.
Like, it's so transfixed in there, you know?
Yeah.
Until you become as still as
you do.
The painting, and
you
therefore,
do.
Yeah.
It is, right. Yeah. No, that's really nice, that there is a kind of quietness. And or like, there's this one of the famous one of the lighthouse at the Met, which I was just looking at the other day, and there's more kind of love and warmth for the lighthouse than for the two women working at the restaurant that's the painting next door, which the two women actually feel more object-like than the lighthouse. So it's just interesting to see where does his warmth come through. It's kind of in color and shape and not really necessarily inside people.
Yeah.
But there's a stillness that sits upon the reader, the viewer that way,
Have you seen photographs of Hopper? He really did not like being photographed either.
Really? I haven't.
Yeah. No, there's some,
he's always looking aside.
Yeah, he's always just really grumbly, like, you know, go away. Which
he's interesting. He's really interesting.
I alluded to the screenwriter apartment complex at the very beginning of this conversation. You take great care in this book to describe tall, graceful pines planted in 1932 by the bigwigs of the movie industry. You have Rose's dad waiting outside the hospital with a cigar for the baby, and Rose describes his jig like the silent movie version of her life. Later in the book, when Rose asks Sherry to go to a movie, she replies, "But why? What's interesting about a movie?" And, of course, late in the book, when Rose goes off to college, she tears down her high school movie posters and replaces them with, paintings, landscapes, and the likes. Obviously, Los Angeles...
Nice work.
Yes. L.A. is clearly one of the reasons for this preoccupation with movies, but I'm wondering if a lot of this movie imagery also comes from the idea that here is something that is an explicit medium that is tearing away our capacity for imagination. Was this a concern of yours? Or?
I mean, I think it's funny, too, how movies now feel kind of benign. Like, there was such a worry growing up, are movies tearing away our imagination? And now it's like, movies feel benign, and now it's like, what about texting? You know, or what about how our attention span is affected by email? Like, it really has shifted form. But I guess, I mean, I grew up in L.A., and I did feel like the strong presence of the movie biz or standing in line to see Indiana Jones for like 4 hours in Westwood. You know, these kind of archetypal going to see the movies, movie viewer experience. But I have ambivalence, you know, about the industry itself. I think it's pretty tough. And I think, you know, a lot of writers, it's hard on writers. And a lot of writers who, you know, get their hearts broken a lot. So, I mean, I guess... I don't know how to address your question specifically. I don't think the movies have harmed our imagination. I just think our imagination is sort of always under fire a little bit, and it takes some work to keep it.
More so than we last talked. I mean, you mentioned social networks and the internet and the like.
Right.
I mean, you're someone who really needs to... I mean, your voice is very fantastical, very phantasmagorical. And with this book, I really see that there's a subtle shift in your relationship between realism and fantasy. And so how can your work continue to occupy this, in my view, graceful subtlety when you're dealing with, I suppose, explicit forces of all types? Almost predators upon the imagination.
I mean, I guess... I mean, I'm trying to think, because it's... I don't necessarily feel that they are... I mean, I like going to the movies a lot, so it's... And there's amazing stuff going on in TV right now, but I guess it's just carving out the time to do reading, too. So as long as there's reading space and time, then I think all is fine in a certain way, because I think the truth is I love words, and I love storytelling via narrative, and I love the internal life that fiction can show up as a reader. I look for those things in other writers all the time. So I don't... I feel like... I feel like the movies can become dangerous if they completely overtake it. But yeah, I would say more, what I've been feeling more worried about has been the dopamine reaction to getting an email and the difficulty in sort of sustained, you know, the sort of, that book, The Shallows, this idea of like, is our reading growing more shallow?
Yeah.
And that feels like a concern. Is our attention span shortening? My students, much more than 5 years ago, will raise their hands and when I call them say, I forgot what I was going to say.
Yeah.
It happens all the time now and it did not happen 5 years ago. So why is that happening? I mean, that's, I think, a computer
relying
thing.
Relying upon Google, relying upon not memorizing details.
Yeah.
Relying upon, oh, hey, here I have a sheet of questions myself, which
well,
I'm
I mean,
sort
we
of
all
working
need
on.
That.
Yeah.
But I think there is a kind of shifting between tasks that's happening a lot more. And like the antidote, I decided last year to feel like to try to start memorizing poems. That was felt like, what did they used to do in the olden days? They sat around and did the Iliad. Of course, I'm not doing the Iliad. I'm doing like 5-line poems. But that felt like a real relief because it feels like there needs to be some kind of counterbalance to that incredible amount of distraction. Or I'm basically on vacation right now because I'm here doing a reading in New York. And so I'm away from my computer and it feels great and it's rare. You know,
what poems were you memorizing?
I memorized a couple Wallace Stevens poems, which were really intense to memorize. Like this final soliloquy of The Interior Paramour, which is a really intense poem. And, you know, and I can't do it here. I feel like I just say them in my car.
You're on vacation.
I'm on vacation. But it actually, like, I had a physical, like, I had a response to memorizing it. It really kind of stirred me up. I felt, like, emotionally connected to the poem in a new way. And I also felt sort of, like, buzzed from memorizing. It was really interesting. It's just, the words are very powerful. When they're that distilled.
Interesting that you'd go for Wallace Stevens.
Right.
I thought
Kay
you would
Ryan,
go for someone more
Robert Frost.
Okay, got it.
Know, yeah.
Interesting. No Edward Lear or anything?
Not yet.
Okay.
But that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Right, a little more
playful. Or Don Marquis.
Oh, Don Marquis. I don't know Don Marquis.
You don't know Don Marquis?
No.
You would love him. Archie and the Hittable. It's he's a cockroach who jumps on each key.
Oh, fantastic.
Yes. Oh, my God. I read these like when I was a kid. I still read them from time to time.
Okay.
I think they're actually republishing a version of Don Marquis. But, there's the cat. Who he's composing little love poems to by jumping from key to key.
Oh,
and they're very, very
incredible.
Sweet.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, that's great. It's a great tip. And Kay Ryan is actually she's very playful and strange.
Yes.
Like she, yeah. She's wonderful.
Well, here's the other thing. I mean, you were talking about seeing students unable to memorize certain things. Do you see.
Just remember their thoughts.
Yeah.
I mean, and they're horrified too. We're all horrified. I can't remember my thoughts. I'll say to the students. And
is there a reading and writing epidemic? Or?
Their reading is the thing. So I guess they are reading and they are really interested in reading, but I just do think there is a new challenge about concentration. I feel it. Do you feel that?
I mean, a little bit, but on the other hand, you could always unplug. You could always sit on the couch for 2 hours. Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
Which is key. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I suppose we'll have to meet again and discuss the fate of the American cultural landscape. Amy,
but I'm not saying
as always, a pleasure. Thanks so much.
That hasn't been said. Oh, Ed, thank you so much for having me. Really a pleasure.
So happy I was in